Okay, tonight we're going, oh, I was just going to mention, out of nostalgia, Dean Hayes brought me this. It's the notes he took at the 1963 two-week meeting in Independence, Missouri, which was Dean's first two-week meeting. It happened to also be my first two-week meeting. I was 14. But he was thumbing through this, and there's apparently was a class taught by a Winford Lee on worship of the church. So I thought that was just kind of nostalgic. Tonight we're going to, as I said last night, deal specifically with the Lord's Supper or the communion. So I want to present some material, and then as you have comments or questions, if you have them, raise your hand and I'll just pause. But if not, I'll try to pause periodically. We touched on this a little bit, but not in depth. There are really three terms in the Bible that I find for the communion. One of them is obviously the communion. You'll find that in 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 16. And there the word communion comes from the Greek word koinonia, which is often translated fellowship in scriptures. And it means a partnership, a sharing, a fellowship. In other words, it means a group activity. And we sometimes call the Lord's Supper communion. It's also called the Lord's Supper. 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 20. And in the book of Acts, it is also referred to as the breaking of bread. Acts chapter 2, verse 42, chapter 20, verses 7 and 11. There is another term, or probably are several, but there's another common term in the religious world for it. And I don't have a problem with this term. I believe the Catholicism uses this term, and maybe some others, and that's the Eucharist. And the reason I don't have a problem with it is I think it has a biblical base, that term, because Eucharist in the Greek means to give thanks. And when Jesus instituted the Lord's Supper, as it's recorded in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, it says he gave thanks for it. So we don't commonly call it the Eucharist, but I don't think that's an inappropriate term. But whether it was the breaking of bread in the book of Acts or the use of the word communion from the word koinonia, it always connotated a coming together or assembling of the saints. When Paul or other writers would talk about it, it was always in the context of the assembly of the saints in a particular location, and that would be what we would commonly refer to as a congregation. But it's interesting that it was intended, it was intended, I believe, as a unifying activity. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, I'm going to read verses 16 and 17. And these are concepts that for me are very important as we look at some of the specific questions that I alluded to that we'd try to at least discuss tonight. In 1 Corinthians chapter 10, verse 16 and 17, it says, "The cup of blessing which we bless, is it not the communion or the fellowship of the blood of Christ? The bread which we break, is it not the communion of the body of Christ?" Verse 17, "For we being many are one bread and one body, for we are all partakers of that one bread." We being many become one. It was meant to be not simply a remembrance of the death, but also a unifying activity of the church. And if you'll remember from your previous studies of the book of Corinthians, in 1 Corinthians chapter 1, verse 10, one of the concerns Paul had for the church at Corinth was that they were becoming divided. And he is concerned that there were divisions among them. And then when we get to chapter 11, we see that one of the divisive things at the church at Corinth had become the Lord's Supper. And that was when they were mixing it with a meal, and the rich and the poor were becoming divided, and he chastises them for that. It's kind of interesting. One of the things that the Lord gave us to unify us, even in our day and age amongst denominations, has become a divisive issue. And some people partake of it monthly, some partake of it quarterly, annually. We partake of it every first day of the week, and I think for good biblical reason. But it was intended to unify, not divide. It's when we try to think, well, wouldn't it be better doing it this way or that way and not doing it the way the Bible tells it, that it can become a divisive thing. But I could say that of all aspects of worship. The primary texts in the New Testament on the communion are Matthew chapter 26, verse 26 and following, Mark chapter 14, verse 22 and following, Luke chapter 22, verse 15 and following, and then 1 Corinthians 11. Some would put John in there because in John 13 you have Jesus with the disciples assembled in the foot washing, but it really doesn't give us a lot of instruction relative to the communion. In two of those passages, in Luke and in 1 Corinthians, Luke and Paul both put the phrase, in remembrance of me. You won't find that phrase in Matthew or Mark, but in Luke and in 1 Corinthians, they put that phrase, the Holy Spirit inserts that phrase, and that's commonly sometimes on the front of our table as we partake of it, and certainly that is one of the two important aspects of communion. It's probable that Jesus partook of the Passover meal four times during his 3.5 years of ministry. We know for sure he did it three times, and I think it's more likely that he did it four, because if the last time he did it was just before he died and you count back 3.5, you get four. And you'll find those in the Gospel of John, chapter 2, verse 13, chapter 5, verse 1, chapter 6, verse 4, and finally in chapter 11, verse 55. But the precursor, or the beginning of the Lord's Supper, really had its roots back in Exodus chapter 12. And I alluded to that with the children, not in terms of the communion, but with the Passover lamb. Exodus chapter 12 is where the Passover was instituted. And I think you're fairly familiar with that. We're going to turn back and pull some thoughts out of that, because I think those thoughts, again, are important for us to maintain as we go through the scriptures. So I'm going to be in Exodus chapter 12 for probably the next 3 or 4 minutes, and you can be there mentally or you can be there physically, however you choose to do this. But this was instituted on the night before they were to exit Egypt. And the Passover lamb was killed, and the blood of the Passover lamb was put over the doors, so that those that were obedient to that request of God's would not have their firstborn child and firstborn of their cattle killed. And we know that the Israelites did that, Pharaoh and the Egyptians didn't, and it was obviously a terribly, terribly difficult time. The Passover was so important to God that that was the time that he instituted or marked the beginning of the Jewish year. It was called the month of Abib, A-B-I-B. It was later called Nisan, N-I-S-A-N. But that began, that month that Passover occurred in, began the Jewish calendar. On the 10th day of that month, they were to select a one-year-old male lamb without blemish. The significance of the 1 year is that would be the lamb as it was coming into productive prime, be it for breeding or getting of a sufficient size to provide meat to eat. And of course, without blemish, I think you can understand the symbolic significance of that, because the New Testament does call Christ our Passover lamb. They selected that lamb on the 10th day. They killed it on the 14th day of Nisan. And that was actually Passover. The 14th day of the first month on the Jewish calendar was the day of Passover. They were to kill it at twilight. Josephus says about 3 in the afternoon. Deuteronomy seems to indicate maybe as the sun was going down. But late afternoon they would kill it. And then they would be prepared then for the Passover meal. If we go back to Exodus chapter 12, just to kind of run through this, they were to roast the whole lamb, certainly not to eat it raw. They weren't to boil it. They were also to prepare unleavened bread, sometimes called in Deuteronomy 16 and 6, the bread of affliction, because symbolizing the affliction of the Israelites in their slavery or captivity in Egypt. And also being unleavened, which means not having yeast. I think you probably recall that the Bible equates in every passage except one that I know of, yeast with sin. There's one passage in the New Testament where I don't think it does that. But in general, yeast or leaven is equated with sin. They were to either eat the entire lamb, or if they couldn't eat the entire lamb, they were to burn whatever they weren't able to eat. There was to be none left over. That's the important point there. In Exodus 12, they were to eat it fully clothed because they had to be prepared to leave. And they did leave, in fact, that night. But obviously it was the shedding of the blood of that Passover lamb that protected the Israelites from the death of the firstborn. And I think you can readily see the symbolism and why the Lord instituted the Lord's Supper on Passover, because of the protection of His blood from our spiritual death of sin, symbolically referring back to the protecting of their actual lives in Exodus chapter 12. And they were to partake of this feast every year. God was very specific when they were to partake of it, and I think God is very specific to us when we are to partake of our Lord's Supper, or our spiritual Passover, if you will. They were to remove all of the yeast from their house on the first day of the Feast of Unleavened Bread, and Orthodox Jews still do that. But there's a couple of other interesting things that we find in Exodus chapter 12. At least I consider them interesting. If the Jews or any of the Jews would eat yeast or leavened bread during this Feast of Unleavened Bread, they were to be cut off from Israel. In other words, if they didn't do it the way the Lord had told them, they were disfellowshipped, excommunicated, they were cut off from Israel. Now, I don't know how far to take that, but it seems to me like if God found the observance of the Old Testament Passover that important, I don't know why would He consider the observance of the death of His Son any less important. So I think that, for me at least, puts a great onus on trying to partake of the Lord's Supper as clearly as we can understand the way the Lord set it up. Failure to do that, as I said, meant being cut off from Israel. When the Israelites, after they wandered for 40 years, crossed the Jordan River, they did two things immediately. Number one, they circumcised all of the uncircumcised men. You find that in Joshua chapter 5, verses 2-9. And then the next three verses, Joshua chapter 5, verses 10-12, they observed the Passover. So they were reobserving, or getting back into the directive of the Lord. I just jotted down a few of the similarities, and I'm going to go through these quickly because I don't want to run out of time, but I don't think they're unimportant. Parallels between the Passover in the Old Testament and the Lord's Supper or communion. The Passover represented Israel being freed from Egypt. I believe the Lord's Supper symbolizes us being freed from slavery. An unblemished lamb was needed to escape that. Jesus was our unblemished lamb. The blood of the lamb protected them from death. The blood of Jesus protects us from physical death. The Passover night was the night that the Israelites became free. The death of Jesus was the time that spiritual freedom from sin became available to us. Israel was given the Passover as a memorial feast. I believe the Lord gave us the Lord's Supper and communion as a memorial feast. If an Israelite abused that memorial feast, he was cut off. I'll leave you to reach your own conclusions as to whether that's a current parallel for us. When an Israelite observed the Passover, he was declaring, "I am a child of God, an Israelite." And I believe today, when we properly partake of the communion, we are stating we are children of God. The Lord's Supper, I believe, is intended to be both a remembrance of Christ's death, and we do a very good job of emphasizing that when we get together, usually. But I want you to also understand that the Lord's Supper was also established as a binding thing to keep God's people together. One of the reasons the Lord gave the Jews feasts was to keep them together, be it the Passover, Feast of Pentecost, Feast of Tabernacles. It was to keep the nation together. And I believe He gave us the Lord's Supper not only to remember the death of Christ, but to bring us together on a regular basis and help bind us together. Kind of interesting, and Orthodox Jews obviously still partake of the Passover. They've added a few things that you won't find in Exodus 12, but I found them interesting. They include in the Passover meal today a hard-boiled egg, which represents the hardening of that the Israelites went through because of their suffering of slavery. They have bitter herbs to betray the bitterness of slavery. They have salt water on the Passover table to remember the tears of the slaves in Egypt. They have something called a harosot, H-A-R-O-S-E-T, which is a mixture of nut, apple, cinnamon, wine mixture, which ends up kind of a straw color, and it seems to maybe depict the brick building and some of the straw. And then they have what they call matzah bread, which you and I would call unleavened bread. I think we're pretty familiar with that. But they put great emphasis today when they observe the Passover, and I believe in the Old Testament, to use it as a teaching experience for their children. And I want to emphasize that. One of the reasons for the Passover was so that the nation would continually teach their children what the Lord had done for them. And I think that is a very important thing for us to keep in mind today. I believe the Lord's Supper is not simply so you and I remember the Lord, not simply to bind you and I together, although I would say those are the two primary reasons, but it seems to me like there may be a real opportunity as we partake of communion, if we do it right with proper conduct and proper attitude, for that to be a tremendous teaching tool for our children. And if you've had children sitting on your knee as the emblems were passed, it's common for them to either grab at them or ask what it's about, or wonder when they're going to get old enough to do it. Boy, those are wonderful teaching opportunities. Now, I know that when we have children, and especially young children in our assembly, they're not always as cooperative as we would like them to be. I had children, well, I've got them, but I mean, I had little children at one time, and most of you have either had or do have. So they're not going to be perfect little angels. And I have absolutely no problem with us bringing things to the assembly that helps occupy their minds, to keep them quiet and so forth during the service. But I would at least ask you to consider that of all the times when we're assembled together, the time when they should, if at all possible, sit quietly without any distraction and observe what's going on, I'm going to submit to you that would probably be, my vote would be, it be during the communion, because it is such a powerful teaching tool. The purposes of the communion were to remember Christ and the collective affirmation of our oneness. And you know, when you get to 1 Corinthians 11, they had turned it into something different than that, and Paul has to reason with them. I don't think 1 Corinthians 11 is telling us it's wrong to eat in the building. It's telling us it's wrong to lose our focus during the Lord's Supper. It's kind of interesting that in the first century, two of the probably most basic foods were bread and grape juice or wine, because that's what they had. And there's probably many of an Israelite or a Palestinian that bread and grape juice or wine was the difference between life and death. That may have been what many of them had to eat. And it seems to me like there's an interesting parallel there for us. As Christians, this communion service, if we do it right, is the difference between spiritual life and spiritual death. Paul in 1 Corinthians 11 and 2 Corinthians 13 does exhort us to examine ourselves. And Paul uses the phrases in 1 Corinthians 11, make sure you don't do it unworthily. Now there's really two aspects to his use of that phrase in two or three verses in 1 Corinthians 11. One is, I think we need to examine ourselves to see that there is no leaven in our hearts or sin, and if possible, get it out. But unworthily is really an adverb, so I think even more than that, he's talking about make sure you do it in the proper way, with the proper focus. Communion with ourselves, with others, and certainly focus on the Lord. I remember when I was growing up, I would sometimes be passing the emblems as a young child, and some of the men in my home congregation in Indiana would completely kind of just bend over as if they were praying and close their eyes to focus on what was going on. I used to worry about that as a young man. I didn't know if they'd know when I got to their row. And there's been times when wives have kind of had to nudge them. But I really come to appreciate that focus, if that's what they were able to do, because I think the communion requires that kind of focus for us to do it right. Now I want to talk for just, well, let me stop. I'm going to talk now about weekly observance of the Lord's Supper, and I want to talk now about multiple times on the Lord's Day, taking it outside the assembly, and if time permits, multiple cups versus one. But before I get into those more practical, applicable things to us today, let me pause and see if anybody has a comment or a question you would like to make on this or anything I've said so far. You got one over here, Marty. Mary? Just a minute, so everyone can hear you.
Isn't there a certain way we should dress on Sunday mornings when we come for the Lord's table?
Isn't there a certain way we should dress? Well, that's a yes and a no, but I don't want to dodge the question. Yes, I think there is, in a sense, there's not a uniform. There's not a priestly garb like they did in the Old Testament. But I think when we come to worship, one of the things that's consistent in scriptures, whether it was in the offering or the grain or whatever, was people giving the Lord their best. So in the sense that I think we should dress in a way that connotates reverence and the giving of our best, I would agree with you. Now we can talk about what form that takes, and then we get into differences of opinion and preference. And I certainly have opinion, and I certainly have preference. But I think there are ways we can dress that depict or portray to other people less than a reverential tone. And I would urge us to thoughtfully consider that so that we don't do it. Let me give you an example. And I don't know if this has even happened in your congregations, but I was at a congregation, and I didn't witness this, but some of the men or young men, I don't know if they were giving the table talk or passing emblems, they had on t-shirts that had lots of print on them and commercials. Well, I can't turn to a verse and say that's wrong, but it doesn't seem to me to portray the solemnness and the reverential spirit that I prefer. I'll just say that. I'm not trying to bind something on anybody that the Bible doesn't bind, but there's a reason I got a white shirt and a tie on tonight, and it's not because it's comfortable. Anytime I'm presenting the Lord's Word to a group, people are nice enough to give me the chance to present the Lord's Word, I just feel better about trying to do it in a way that portrays the way I feel. Anybody else want to have a comment or ask Dean? Just a minute. I didn't mean by that last comment, I think you all have to wear white shirts and ties. That was not my point. I'm talking about the way I feel. Dean?
You made mention of the Passover and the meat that was used for the Passover, and that what wasn't consumed was destroyed or burnt. What is your thinking concerning the fruit of the vine that happens to be blessed and left over after we have the Lord's Supper?
Lord's Supper. Okay. Good. Another good question, one of which the Bible is, as far as I can tell, totally silent. So I don't want to bind things. I remember as a young child, my mom would fix the communion table, and basically the communion loaf, physically it's pie dough or pie crust in some form. And I can remember I'd like to help her clean up because I like to eat it because I love pie crust. And she never would let me do it. But she would always, when she was making the loaves, make some extra, and I could have the extra. But she wouldn't let me eat it after it had been part of the communion. I can't take a firm stance that it's wrong, but I think as part of the reverential and part of teaching our children, for instance, I would recommend that we simply discard what isn't used rather than for instance, letting our kids drink it. And that's, I want to clarify that I feel that's my opinion, but it, there's just something special about it. There's something reverential about it to me. And I know it's just flour and shortening and salt and water, but no, it's not just flour and short. It symbolizes the Lord's body, and I like to treat it with respect. We got Peter and then Allison.
Yes, sir. What kind of latitude do we have in our presentation of the Lord's Supper? Some people like to use, every time I take this cup and take this bread of 1 Corinthians there, and there's a lot of latitude we can go from there. Like I used Exodus, and you know, and compare the two, or do you have to always say, take the cup and be the same every time?
You mean in terms of what we say about it? I'm not sure I totally...
The brethren that's up there serving and making the presentation before the syrup, you know, everybody used first, up on the first day of the week, you know, he took the cup, and then they took the bread, and nobody ever goes back and get the history and contrast it with the Old Testament, the New Testament, things like that.
Okay, I'm not sure I totally followed your question, so I know you well enough that if I didn't, you'll ask it again. Well, let me make this comment, and I hope it addresses your question. Let me just put it that way. I think we have some latitude in what we say about it when we're officiating at the Lord's Supper. I think we certainly should do it in the sequence that the Lord instituted it, the bread and then the cup. We should certainly have a prayer for it. Technically, the prayer, I think, came before the breaking of the bread, so I like to do it that way. Do I come unglued if somebody forgets and prays before they break it? No, I don't come unglued because it's usually just an honest mistake. But I think that we should follow that order, and our comments on the Lord's Supper or the person officiating should be very much directed at that. You know, we have sermon time. We have class time. I think our comments on the Lord's Supper should be specifically addressed toward getting everyone's minds focused on it. You've heard me speak, and you know that I'll use anecdotes and stories and sometimes a little humor in my lessons. I wouldn't do any of that in a Lord's Supper talk. That's the time to be really focused. Those of us that give Lord's Supper talks, we often feel bad because we can't think of anything new to say. No, it's not. It's a problem for us. I'm over that. In fact, I don't think we should try to find anything new to say. Remind them of it, and don't ever feel bad if you don't find anything new to say, as long as you're telling them what the Bible says about it. Because it's for us to remember, and we're forgetful. So I don't worry about being repetitive if I have to give the table talk, and it seems like I'm saying the same thing. As long as it's right, I'm happy if the table talk's the same every Sunday, if it focuses on it. Now, some people like a little change, and we're all going to say it a little bit differently, but I don't rack my brain to find something new to say about communion, because I don't think there's anything new to say about it. And let's just remind each other. And it doesn't have to necessarily be long, but I think we should spend time trying to get people's minds focused. You know, I did this once, and I was wrong. I got up, I had the table talk, and I said, well, you all know why we're here. There's nothing I can say to add to why you know we're here, so let's pray for it. And it wasn't quite that abbreviated, but I don't think I was right. I should have spent some time recounting what had happened. Help people. Help us get our minds back on it. Allison?
I have a technical question. I am wondering if it matters whether or not it's red grape juice or white grape juice. And mostly because we had Well, one time Lowell bought white grape juice because there wasn't any blue grape or red grape juice at the store, but nobody would use it, just sat in the refrigerator forever. Anyway, okay, I'll let you address that. And then the other thing was is that I was also wondering if there would be a problem. I'm not saying that I want this. I'm just saying this mostly because I'm curious.
Oh, really?
If it were wine rather than grape juice.
Okay, two good questions. First question, does it matter if it's red or white? I don't know why in the world it would. The Bible doesn't say red or white. I don't know for sure which they used. It was probably red because that was most accessible. But I think fruit of the vine was clearly grape juice as it was used at the Passover. I don't have any reason to feel that color would make any difference there. We're more used to probably the red. So I'd probably say use it just so nobody wonders about it, because we don't want them wondering about the color. We want them to think about the Lord. The second part, would it be appropriate to use wine, and by that she means alcoholic content, rather than grape juice? I don't think that would be unbiblical. And I have been at one communion service in a Church of Christ where they did use wine. But I wouldn't recommend it. They did it back then. When they did it, and if they did it, they did it because they didn't have access to unfermented grape juice. So they didn't have a choice. And if you're in a situation where you don't have access to unfermented grape juice, wine would be appropriate. But I wouldn't recommend it because we don't need to do that, because in our country we have free access to grape juice. And even though it's hard for many of us to appreciate, there are people that even a small amount of alcohol can cause them to have to fight an addiction more severely than most of us would have to. When I did it, I didn't have an addictive problem. I had a shock problem because I didn't know it was wine. And it was distracting, because what happened is I was on the second row. I started watching everyone else to see if anyone else was going like this. But it wasn't unbiblical. But I would not recommend it because we don't need to. It could cause somebody who's really struggling with an alcoholic problem, an unnecessary temptation, and it would be disruptive for us. And we need all the help we can, focusing on what we need to be focused on, not worrying about the color. But those are two good questions. Thank you. Anybody else want to ask a question or make a comment? Donna.
I'd like to know how we are to dispose of the bread and the juice afterward.
Well, obviously the Bible doesn't tell us how to dispose of the bread and the juice, so I don't want to speak where the Bible's silent. I would simply say I would recommend you do it in a reverential way. Well, what's that mean? It means different things to different people. When I helped Donna clean up after communion, we just put it in a trash bag, and then it gets discarded with the trash. We don't have a separate ceremony where we all huddle around and watch it evaporate. That would probably be a bit presumptuous on our part. But we just dispose of it in such a way that the children don't get into it and that. Follow up, Marty, with Donna. And I would like to know some other thoughts on that. I really haven't thought that much about it because I don't do it that often, to be honest.
Well, what I was thinking was it goes into the trash. It ends up at the dump. It ends up with the rats eating it.
What was the last part? It ends up where?
Probably at the landfill, the dump.
Yeah.
And then the rats get in it.
Yeah.
And I just don't think
that doesn't seem reverential to you.
No.
I think each of you should ask your elders how to dispose of it. Well, if that doesn't seem reverential to you, find a way that does. I don't have a problem with it. You know, it's kind of like the question, how do you dispose of an old Bible? Well, some people prefer to burn it so that it doesn't get tattered and torn. I'm fine with that. Your attitude really is the key here. Doing it in an attitude that you feel is reverential. But I have burnt Bibles, but I've also just put them in the trash bag. I don't give them to little kids to color on. And the Bible, not that that would be wrong, the book is just paper and print, but we're teaching our children reverence toward these things. That's the point that's, and maybe teaching ourselves some reverence toward these things. And that's important to me. Anybody else care to make a comment or ask a question? Marion up front here, Marty.
When I made the communion with the bread after dark, couldn't throw it, just throw it away. I had to wrap it in another.
You got to put
paper.
That in front of your mouth for it to work.
I couldn't throw it away. I always had to wrap it in a nice clean paper napkin and dispose of it. I felt
and you were doing that with a reverential attitude, and that's all I can ask. And I don't want to be crude. It's kind of like, how do you dispose of a body? Well, some people feel very strongly you got to put it 6 feet under the ground. That's fine. But Jesus was buried above ground. So it's hard for me to bind that. Some people think cremation's appropriate. I don't think the Bible talks against it, but some people aren't comfortable with it. You treat the body, because it's a creation of God, in a reverential way. And different societies have done that differently. Some have burned, some bury. You know, I wouldn't, and I don't mean this to be flippant, I wouldn't put a body in a hefty bag for the trash man. That's not reverential. So you just have to use some common sense and judgment. When the Bible doesn't tell us, we have to. But reverence, I think, is the key there. Anybody else? Okay, I want to talk a little bit, and I'm not going to quite get through this, so with your permission, we may take a few minutes tomorrow night finishing up. I was going to talk about how often we observe it, and obviously we in the churches of Christ, there may be churches of Christ that don't do it weekly, but I'm not familiar with any, so despite all the differences even within the Church of Christ, I think most all of them do it weekly. But we'll talk a little bit about that tomorrow night if we have time. But I wanted to talk about maybe a couple of shorter topics that'll fit into my time frame. What about having it multiple times on the Lord's Day? And this began primarily in America during World War II, when the factories were running and people couldn't get to church in the morning, and then some of them couldn't get to church at night. Well, I'm not saying that was wrong during that time, because it was special time. But I think it defeats one of the primary purposes of the Lord's Supper. The Lord's Supper is not simply to remember the Lord's death. It's also for us to commune as a body. Well, we can have it six times a day. We can leave it on the table, and people could come in and partake of it whenever they wanted and remember the death. But we can't commune together. We can't have that fellowship of the body when we do it in stages. So I am not an advocate or a fan of having it multiple times. And people say, well, some people have to work on Sunday morning. You know, doctors, nurses. You know, if I'm in the hospital, I don't want all the nurses to leave for communion. But it seems to me like that if I'm sick, or if I have an essential job, essential, not an optional, but an essential job, that keeps me away from the communion service when my congregation does it, the Lord understands that. And if I don't have a legitimate reason for not being there, doing it later in the day isn't going to absolve me of why I wasn't there earlier in the day. So I don't see the benefits of having it multiple times. And it does, I think, sometimes in some people place a temptation in front of them to schedule their Lord's Day activities. No, to schedule their Lord's Day worship around their activities. And I much think we need to have our Lord's Day worship as our top priority and schedule other things around that. I have been a member of a congregation that did it two times a day. And I was part of the decision in favor of it. And we hadn't done it more than 2 months. And I and the rest of the congregation were uncomfortable with it. It took us a while to get it stopped. It just seems to me to defeat the whole communion of the family together. So I am not an advocate of it. I don't care what time of the Lord's Day a congregation chooses. If Pleasant Hill decided to have the Lord's Supper at 6 p.m., that would be totally biblical. We typically have it in the morning. It's a convenience, tradition, and that's fine too. It's not the time, it's the multiplicity of it that I find a little questionable. Does anybody want to ask a question or a comment on that, Lowell?
I've got a problem with Sunday night. With God's time, it was different than our, evening and morning.
Mm-hmm.
One problem, maybe certain times a year you're okay on Sunday night, but I have a real qualm about Sunday night communion if it was dark. Isn't that the start of Monday?
Well, yeah. Yes and no. Lowell is alluding to, in the Jewish calendar, their day started like at 6 p.m. and went to 6 p.m. So if you go to Israel, where there might be a church, they might have the communion at 7, what to us is 7 p.m. on Saturday. But for their culture, that's the first day of the week, because the first day of the week starts at 6 p.m. So technically, I understand. But for our culture, the first day of the week is midnight to midnight. So I think that I would not be as uncomfortable with it, because we go by our clock rather than by a Hebrew clock. But if you're uncomfortable with it, don't do it. I mean, that's the easy question. I know in Israel, where Ellie is at, they do partake of it on what we call Saturday night, but it's after 6 p.m., so to the Jew, it's the first day of the week, because in the Jewish culture, most of them are still Jews, so the Sabbath day is the day they have off work, and what we call Sunday, they have to go back to work. And I don't have a problem with that, but for us to have the Lord's Supper on Saturday evening, I think would be wrong from the standpoint our culture would not look at it as the first day of the week, because in our society it's not the first day of the week. So why cause that confusion? Let's just keep it on the first day of the week. And if you have it in the morning, then you're covered. It's on the Jewish first day of the week, and it's on the American first day of the week. So you can't really go wrong. Peter.
In Houston, in the sick and the shut-ins,
yeah,
and the people in the hospital, we used to take it to them, or they used to bring it to whomever was at the hospital. Is that incorrect?
Well, his question was my next one, about taking it to shut-ins, to nursing homes. He said, is that incorrect? I'm not sure I quite want to use the word incorrect, but I'm not comfortable with it, and I'll tell you why. I can sure understand the emotional pull. Someone who's maybe been a brother or sister for years and partaken of communion for 50 years, and it's hard for them to not do it. But when we start taking the Lord's Supper out of the assembly of the congregation, I don't know where that slippery slope stops. And again, I'm not trying to be facetious, but someone might be a real shut-in, and maybe I've just got a tummy ache, so I don't want to get up. So I call Peter and say, bring the communion to me. Well, he might do that, and if that's his conscience, I'm not going to get all lathered up about it, but I go back to one of the primary purposes of it is for the family to come together. And when we start doing it in a way that the family's not all together or have the opportunity to be all together, I think we defeat one of those primary purposes, which is the unifying of the body. And so I'm not in favor of it. I don't stand in the pulpit and rant and rave if people do it, because I know some congregations do it. This is my feeling on it. And so I'd say that with nursing homes and with sick. I touched on vacations last night, but to me that's even more of problematic, because we're putting our recreation ahead of our communion with the Lord. And well, I talked about that last night, so I don't need to repeat myself. Would anyone else care to comment on that? And you sure don't have to agree with my position. Got one up here.
In talking on this subject one time with a family member, the thought was brought up that usually in your congregation you do not have the entire family together. There possibly every Sunday morning are a few people gone for whatever reason. So partaking of the Lord's Supper, you're never doing it together as a family, as a whole family. Thus, when they took the communion to the hospital into shut-ins, they would take probably 3 to 4 people with them. And that way they had a group, a small family representation of the family. And I could not get around that.
Okay.
Because that's true. We do not have the whole family together every Sunday. Can you help me with that?
I don't know. It's true. If you have a congregation of any size, not every member is going to be there. But every member knows we're going to partake of it and has the opportunity or is invited. Okay? It's a congregational activity when it's under the oversight of the elders and the leadership of that congregation. It's not that it's in the church building that I'm hung up on. It's that the congregation is doing it as much as they can as a whole. I just don't see any precedent in scriptures for it being done outside of the assembly of the congregation. Even though in the New Testament, I'm sure not every member got there every Sunday. Illness, work, whatever. Now I can see a scenario, and I don't want us to abuse this, and I've never seen it done, but you could have a nursing home that had 4 or 5 Christians in that nursing home. And theoretically, you could form a congregation there with an evangelist having the oversight of it. And to me, then that becomes a different scenario. Now, we could abuse that real quick. You know, we could end up with... But it's not impossible. Several of us were talking about this relative to the Eminence Campout. Why do we on Sunday morning go to these churches or these congregations? It's so that we will do this in a congregational assembly, not in an ad hoc assembly. And I guess that's what I'm really comfortable with, because I don't know where that ends. I mean, then you're back to any time 2 people are together, they can have communion, so why ever come to the assembly? Marvin.
Don't you believe that Paul teaches in the 11th chapter of Corinthians that I should be able not only to observe the bread as representing Christ's body and the fruit of the vine as his blood, but I should also be able to observe the body of Christ in the people that are there. If we account for every person that's absent, this is all of the Lord's body that can be there, supposedly.
Theoretically, it's all of the Lord's body that can be there. That's a good point. That's a good point. Anybody else want to have a question or make? I've got to bring the children up. If there's interest, we can talk about one cup versus multiple cups. I do want to spend a little bit of time on why we do it weekly, and then we'll move into mutual edification probably tomorrow night. Anybody else have a comment or a question as the children are coming up? Charles?
One of the times that stands out for me for taking the Lord's table at Vendée was a time when we had some people get stuck on the way to church and we couldn't partake of the Lord's table on time and then be able to make it there. And so we waited on Lord's table till they got there, and the reaction of the members was amazing, because it showed how important it was that this is what we're coming together for primarily, is to remember this. And if we need to wait 15 minutes because somebody's broke down their car until we can get them here, then that shows some real importance.
Yeah, and I don't know that I say. feel that the Lord's Supper is any more important than other acts of worship, but it is the one act of worship that we're commanded to do on the first day of the week, where the other acts of worship we can do at other times. So in that sense, it does have a priority. In my home congregation, we used to not have a set order of service, and Kelly will remember this when he was with us. So sometimes the Lord's Supper would be first, and sometimes it would be last. That has some pluses in that it tended to get everybody there and not have this influx, but it does have negatives. because sometimes people would not be able to get there on time, and we'd have to adjust. So we've kind of evolved into having it toward the end. But hopefully we can stay away from just having people come for the Lord's Supper and not come for the other parts of edification. If you have specific things you would like for me to address on this that we haven't touched on or I haven't indicated we will, just let me know. And several of you have been very kind in doing that last night. So thank you.